Well, I'd like you to remember all those times I quit early. Actually, I talked to Keith beforehand, and I said, don't worry about it, you know, use the time you need. And I'm glad he did. We don't talk to each other about what our sermons are going to be about, our messages. They just happen. And a lot of times they happen to meld right in together, and that's the way it is today. I think he took care about half of mine anyway. So, but before I get started, in the announcement bulletin, it talks about the next leadership meeting, which is on December 11th instead of December 18th. And the reason we did that is because we are changing the next leadership club to December 18th. So I want to give a plug for that next leadership meeting. That'll be after church on December the 18th, not to be confused with the next leadership meeting, as opposed to the leadership club. Well, today I'm going to talk about an aspect of our relationship with God. And it'll blend right in, like I said, with what Mr. Olson was talking about. Because God looks on the heart. We know that. And God is very concerned with what's in our heart and in our relationship with Him. Let's just dive right in and turn over to Jeremiah 17. We're all pretty much familiar with Jeremiah 17:9, which says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Then it says, who can know it? But verse 10 gives us the answer. God says, I, the Lord, search the heart. I'm reading out of the New King James. The King James Version says, I try the reins. In the New King James, it says, I, the Lord, search the heart. And then it says, I test the mind. So in our lives and during our lives, God will test us. He will test what's in our heart, test what's in our mind. How does God do that? That's what I want to talk about today. How does God do that? Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10. It says, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, was involved in their lives. But he said, but with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of those also tempted, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor murmur, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now verse 11, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. And verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond that which you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you will be able to bear it. So we see in verse 11 that all these things in the Old Testament happened to them as an example, and also for our admonition. Now, most of the time we say, well, yeah, they did a lot of things that were wrong, and they paid the penalty, and that's a good example for us. We shouldn't do bad things, right? Well, that's right. But also embedded in this is the example of how God tests the heart and the mind. If we look at their example, we can see how God tests the heart and the mind, and how he tests our heart and our mind. So let's turn back to Deuteronomy 8. I'm going to spend a little time in Deuteronomy as well. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 8. Deuteronomy was written right before the children of Israel went into the Promised Land. And it's written in the form of a constitution of the nation of Israel. And in chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers." In verse 2, "And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness." And then it says, why? It's to humble you and to test you and to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. You know, that's 40 years. God wanted to know if they would keep his commandments or not. And then in verse 3, "So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Your garments did not wear out, nor did your feet swell those 40 years. And then verse 5, "So you shall know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord God chastens you." Now put yourself into this, and let's put it in terms of our life. And go back to verse 2. You know, I'm 55, so it says, "And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 55 years, you know, in this life, to humble you and to test you and to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep God's law or not." You know, that's really what God is doing in all of our lives. He's going to determine if we will keep his law or if we won't, if we will fear him or if we won't. And this is how God tests us. Now, in our lives, we tend to think that everything that's bad, quote unquote, comes from Satan, and everything that's good comes from God. But God chastens us. You know, some situations don't come across as being all that wonderful. But God chastens us as a man chastens his son, corrects us, tests us. In Revelation 3:19, we don't need to turn there, but God says, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten." And you can write in your notes also, in Hebrews 12, Paul talks a lot about chastening. He talks about how it's not pleasant at the time it's happening, but yet what comes from it is the fruit of righteousness. It's not pleasant at the time. So let's get into this a little more. Turn to Psalms 107. Psalms 107 and verse 23. It says, "Those who go down to the sea in ships, who do business on great waters, they see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he commands and raises the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves of the sea. They mount up to the heavens. They go down again to the depths. Their soul melts because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunken man and are at their wit's end." So here we see that God brings a storm upon these sailors. Now, it's interesting that it's God who does this. You know, it isn't Satan that's doing this. It's God who brings the storm upon these sailors and brings them to their wit's end, brings them to the point that they don't know what to do. And it's interesting, in our lives, a lot of times we're brought to our wit's end. You know, we just don't know what to do. You know, there's no way out. Let's read on and see why God does this. Verse 28 says, "Then they cry out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brings them out of their distress. He calms the storm so that the waves are still. Then they're glad because of the quiet, so he guides them to their desired haven." So God brings them to a point in their life where they don't know what to do. They're at their wit's end. And what he wants is for us to trust God, and then God will lead us out of it. It's interesting when we look at how God dealt with the children of Israel in those 40 years and through the Exodus, that many times God would lead them to a position where they were at their wit's end, where they really didn't know what to do. Let's turn to Exodus 14. Keith was there. We'll go back. Because all this time, imagine this. Put yourself in the children of Israel's place. You have a cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night. And you follow that pillar of fire at night and cloud by day. The cloud stops, you stop. It moves, you move. It's a miraculous thing. It's very obviously miraculous. So God is leading you. And let's start in chapter 14. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before this place I can't pronounce, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal of Zephron. You shall camp before it by the sea." So he told them exactly where to camp. Now see, God doesn't always tell us what he's doing. You know, we're on a need-to-know basis, and most of the time we don't need to know. And that's the same situation they were in. God knew what he was going to do, but they didn't. So God says, "For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they're bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed them in." He'll say, oh, those guys don't know where they're going. You know. "Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And they did so. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, for they said, "Why have we done this and let Israel go from serving us?" So they made their chariots ready and took 600 choice chariots, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he pursued them. Verse 10, "When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, so that they were afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord." So here they were afraid. "And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt?" You know, we put ourselves in this position, and a lot of times we do the same thing. You know, we find ourselves in a position where there's no way out. I mean, there are a lot of people, a lot of the times, you know, I've found myself in this position where there's no way out. You know, it's impossible. I still remember Keith Olson's sermonette on God of the Impossible. You know, God really seems to enjoy doing things that are impossible. A lot of times, you know, like the Red Sea. You know, why not go around? Well, let's do something that's impossible here. Because he wanted to see if Israel would trust him or not. He gave them opportunity after opportunity to trust him. and they never seemed to be able to do it. You know, it's like, you know, this miracle happened, I'm being led by the pillar of fire and the cloud during the day, so why can't I see that I'll be okay in the future? And they never could do that. God set up circumstances that they had to trust him. He boxed them in between the sea and the mountains, where the only way out was miraculous. And God did, even though through their lack of faith, God still saved them. But we see later on, he's leading them again, and he leads them out following the cloud again, leads them to a place where there's no water. You know, he did that on purpose. Led them to a place where there's no water. Now, why couldn't they say, well, you know, he took us through the Red Sea, he, you know, fed us manna, I'm sure this is going to work out okay. You know, but they didn't do that. Time and time again, you know, they would murmur, they would do this, they would not trust God, and he gave them those opportunities over and over. But sometimes we do the same thing. You know, we see God working in our lives, but yet it's still easy to find ourselves in a situation where there's really no visible way out, and yet not trust where we really should. A while ago, I gave a sermon about our relationship with God being that we are little children. And it's interesting that a little child, you know, the trust that a little child has is really an amazing thing. Because I remember with my boys, I could take my boys when they were small, you know, and throw them up in the air and then catch them. You know, it's like, do it again, you know. Throw them up in the air and catch them. Well, they have that trust. Now, us as adults, you know, we get thrown up in the air and, you know, start screaming. You know, because we understand the danger, maybe, that's it. But if we could just trust, you know, have that kind of trust in God, that when he throws us up in the air, which, you know, sometimes it seems like we've been thrown up in the air, you know, and there's no safety net, it seems. But, you know, God's there. And in our lives, when that happens to us, if we could simply trust, you know, that God would take care of us, which he will. But then our lives would be so much more peaceful. You know, we could have so much more peace in our life if we simply trusted God. So over and over again in our lives, God puts these tests in front of us. God never tempts us. You know, God tests us, but he doesn't tempt us. Satan tempts us with sin, but God never does. But God will allow instances in our life to come up where we have golden opportunities to trust God to bring us through, where we have golden opportunities for God to test our heart, to see how we're reacting to what God is doing in our lives. And if we could just trust him always, like a little child, that would be so much better for us if we could get rid of the fear, like Keith was talking about. To have that trust. Now we get back to thinking back to Deuteronomy 8. You know, we need to remember that God has led us through everything that has happened in our life. Now, we do, you know, there are other things that factor into this. I mean, we do pay the penalty for our own mistakes, obviously. But many times, God uses the circumstances in our lives to find out just what we're made of. As Keith was saying, you know, God will fight for us. You know, many times we come to a situation and we place our trust in God and then we wait. You know, and time passes and God's not doing anything, you know, as far as it looks to us. So what do? We say, well, I guess it's up to me. So we take it back. And that's, you know, a lot of times that's when it really gets messy. You know, when we, you know, we've given it to God and then we take it back. Say, okay, I'm going to have to deal with this. You know, we really need to leave it in God's court. We need to do our part, but we need to allow God to work in our lives. In Abraham's life, you know, Abraham had many trials, had many opportunities. But finally, when God really wanted to know what Abraham was made of, he told him to sacrifice Isaac. And as he was traveling to the mountain, Isaac said, you know, I see the wood, but where's the sacrifice? And Abraham said, well, God will provide. God will provide the sacrifice. But when they got there and Abraham was about to kill Isaac, then, I mean, he was on the downstroke with the knife, and God said, don't do it. But after that was all over, what did God say? He said, now I know that you will fear me always. You know, and I think that in our lives, God is going to have to get to that point. I think all of us have that coming, where God will have to say of us, you know, now I know. After a lifetime of testing and trial and chastisement, you know, correction by God. But this is all part of God's plan for us. And if we can recognize that it is God's plan, you know, life isn't supposed to be, you know, a walk in the park. But life has its ups and downs. You know, as some people have said, life isn't meant to work. You know, we seem to go from one problem to another. If things are just all wonderful for you, you know, just wait a while. So, but of course, with growing and putting God's principles to practice, you know, our lives should be, you know, should be getting better. But rest assured, we will be tested. With all of this going on, if we learn to fear God and to trust God as a little child, place our trust in Him, and as the trials come, to learn to have the faith and the peace through the trials, it's very comforting to me to know that God our Father is involved in my life, and that it's not just, you know, one attack after another by Satan, but that God uses these to mold us, shape us, to bring us to the place that we need to be. You know, God knows what part of that spiritual building we're going to be, and we're being shaped to be a part of that building. You know, we don't know exactly, you know, what our place is going to be, but God does, and He brings about situations in our life to make sure that we're ready for that. And it's very comforting to know that God is involved rather than it's just, you know, some horrible trial. So sometime, you know, God is going to come to the point, as with Abraham, that God says, now I know that you will fear me always, keep my commandments. And God tests us so that we come to the point that Keith was talking about, where we fear God always. Our goal is great. You know, we have a high calling. We have the high calling of Jesus Christ. I was counseling a young lady for baptism one time, and she just kept smiling. Just kept smiling. And I said, "It's just too good to be true, isn't it?" And she goes, "Yeah, it is." You know, when we think about our goal and what has been set before us, it's like it's too good to be true. It's just that awesome, the goal that we have. But we do have some trials and some chastening to go through on the way. But it's worth every bit of it. No matter what we have to go through, no matter what we have to endure, it's worth it to be there when Jesus Christ returns to this earth. And until it's said of us, "Now I know." It's nice to know that from God's perspective, everything's right on schedule.